Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time means Peach State Pandemonium. Bo James here with Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates. How you guys doing?
I'm doing fine, but I think Bobby's wore out.
I'm pooped, but other than that, I'm good.
Oh, if they could only hear the conversations we had before we go on the air.
Yes, yes. I told somebody today, I stopped at the laundry and picked some clothes up on the way home, and I told them, I was telling them about the show. And I said, you know, and Rich Tate will tell you this is the truth. I made every excuse in the world why not to do this show. Don't have enough time, you know, not interested. And he begged me to do it. And I swear, it's my favorite 2 hours of the week. I miss it when we don't do it.
Go right ahead, Jerry.
I said it gets pretty interesting.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Yeah, even when I'm not hosting, I make sure I listen. If I can't listen live, I'll listen to the download it, listen to it later in the weekend. Sometimes me and Misty will listen when we're riding in the car making the town somewhere on Friday or Saturday. And it's become a weekly tradition here. And by the emails I've got, the Facebook messages the last few weeks, it's a weekly tradition for a lot of people.
I certainly hope so.
Me too. I hope they enjoy it as much as I do. If they do, then they're having a good time.
We just got to figure out a way to charge them to listen now.
Oh, please. You're not getting a check, Bo?
Put Charlie on that, Bobby.
Yeah. If there's anybody can figure out a way, it would be Charlie Smith and we can get paid for doing this. No, I enjoy just the last few weeks being on here. I've had a blast. You know,
I hope so.
For the ones that don't know, Michael Norris will be back next week, and I'm so glad he's able to get back to doing the show, but I'm going to miss doing it. But I'll be listening and calling in when I can, and if he ever needs me to sit in, I will gladly do it.
Well, you've done a wonderful job, Bo.
Yeah, you have. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a question, sir, kind of off the record here, or maybe on the record. You heard anything from your book publisher?
Oh,
well,
I'm going down there.
I should have about a book and $42 in change coming back.
I
got to go catch a call. I'll be back.
All right.
Okay.
Bye. You
bought one book. I paid for several. the word is I will have them next week. So I'm glad. I mean, like I said a couple weeks ago and last week, the proof looked so good. I was so pleased with it. You know, I wrote every word, and Donnie Brandon, he edits it for me, and he puts the pictures in the right places, and I mean, he did a great job, and I think the layout stuff is much better this time than the first one. Not saying the first one was bad, because I was really pleased with it, too.
Had a little better grip on what you was doing this time, so.
Yeah, because we had no idea what we were doing the first time.
I can tell.
You know, we just worked on it as we went, and it turned out great. Everything in both books, you know, I wrote. I did both covers. other, you know, than the editing stuff and moving a paragraph around or a story around or something. I mean, it's all my work, and I could not get it done without Donnie. And I give him a lot of praise to everybody, you know, that tells me how much they enjoyed the books. And he did another book in between my first book and second book. He did his own book, Observations of Worship, which is a great read for any pastor, any churchgoer, or anybody out there. So, I'll have to get you a copy of that, Bobby.
I'd love to read it.
Yeah, he just took a series of sermons and put them in book form, and he was like me. Until he saw it in printed, he didn't know how it was going to look.
He don't mind plagiarizing sermons, does he?
I heard a preacher say once, the Lord gives it to you for everybody to use.
I've had mine used, and I'll have to be honest. I hear a text, and if it rings a bell with me, I'll salt it away. Not necessarily. I mean, I don't word for word or nothing, but if I get a thought from somebody,
I'm back.
All right.
That was a city motion call, and I had to catch that. So,
Jerry, what's been happening down on the beach this week?
It's been quiet, man. It's the weather just won't really break for the beach, you know. It's overcast, and it just really. We had one good day last Saturday. It was beautiful. Of course, it was packed, but other than that, we just don't get a break down there.
Are you working on the weekends?
Yes, I love working on the weekends.
You get your off days during the week?
Yeah, cause, you see, if I'm off on the weekends, I can't get anything done. See, I had like a doctor's appointment about a spot on my arm I had to go back and see about. If I'm off on the weekends, you can't go to the dentist or whatever you need to do. So I all those years working in the business, we work 7 nights a week, so. I take off on, like, Wednesdays and Thursdays. And I can switch it around any time I want, but I don't mind working weekends.
Well, that's a, you know, I mean, that I'm not being funny now. I'm not being funny, ha-ha. I'm being serious here. That's such a great job you got there riding up down that beach, man. It'd be tough to get me away from there on any day.
Well, you know... Which you know what our Saturdays used to be like here in Georgia. Be at the TV at 8:30 in the morning. It was run. You get home at what, 12 that night,
if you're lucky.
If you were lucky, and so you know, working on Saturdays, that's no big deal to me. In fact, I like it because you know I like it. Like I said, I'm off during the week, and you can do things.
How many people stop you and talk about wrestling down there, Jerry?
The people that know me a lot, you know. You'd be riding the beach and a lot of people ask you, you know, just different questions. Of course, I don't bear going to tell them what I did. You'd be there for an hour.
You don't have a bag of 8x10s with you when you go around on the beach?
I didn't say that, Bo. I didn't say that.
Yeah. You got any T-shirts that you sell out of the back of that little buggy?
Yeah, I get more of my man with the car gets for. You just had to bring that up, didn't you? I could have never told that story.
You didn't tell it to me the first time. The first time I heard it was from Harley.
I told that the other day down at the police station. I thought some of those guys would have to go to the emergency room. That ain't nothing that funny. Oh, Lord.
That story's going to haunt you for years.
Oh, please. Bo, it still does.
Yeah. That and the McGuire twins and Moose Cholock. Everybody's going to know those stories.
I don't think it's the worst.
Charlie Smith had a book out in Vegas that his wife bought for him, and it's probably a 3/4 inch thick, and it's like a coffee table book, but it's a paperback. It's not hardback. It's the history of wrestling or wrestling stars or something. I don't know, but it had this. Each page had a picture and a story about whoever the guy was, and Charlie took it out there, and he was getting them, getting the one's autograph that was there. But I was sitting there thumbing through that book, man, and I come across that picture of Moose Cholock with that big moose head on, and I
it's one of the boogies at all.
We didn't get to Moose Cholock last week, but Handsome Jimmy's got a few. stories. He had to work with him in Indianapolis and Chicago for 10 years. And he said Moose Cholock called the Valiant Brothers Duck and Dodge because he'd shoot him in. One would duck one way, the other one would dodge the other way.
How that man got the business, I don't know.
He said every time the Bruiser switched, they knew Bruiser was getting ready to switch because he'd switch Moose too. That way he didn't have to work with him.
Well, I guess he did. I told a story one night. Geigel told me that him and somebody were working against Moose Cholock. No, I got that wrong. Geigel and Moose Cholock were partners against Joe Tangaro and somebody else in St. Louis. Well, he broke Joe Tangaro's nose and Geigel's ribs. Broke his partner's ribs. You go figure that out.
That's like Joe Turner talking about Ox Baker. He said you could be his tag team partner and get beat up.
Yeah.
Well, you know that.
Yeah. Handsome said, he said, Moose would hurt you just saying hello to you.
Oh, it was awful. It was awful.
Oh. Handsome tells a story, too, where him and Joe LeDuc worked with, where the Valiants worked with Moose and Joe LeDuc 2 out of 3 in Chicago, and they never let Moose get in until the finish on the third fall. And he was standing in the corner just cussing, tag me. And wouldn't let Joe get to him.
You don't want none of that action, I'm telling you. Big goose. I don't know if he didn't know any better. I think he didn't know any better. He was just an idiot. I don't know what it was.
He one of them you felt for days, huh?
Years. I'm still talking about it.
he left an everlasting impression on you.
That happened in 1975.
And several other
man.
People.
That was in 1975. I remember it like it was last night. I wake up in the middle of the night seeing moose horns.
You might have been better off having the match with the moose head he wore to the ring.
You can always tell it's going to be a fun night when you got to work with somebody you've never been in the ring with and all the boys come out of the dressing room to watch.
They were watching. Harley and Briscoe.
That's Saturday night.
They all said, you should have knocked him out. I was trying to get over in St. Louis. I didn't want to get fired. I'd have probably got pushed right to the top quicker. Try to knock him out.
When did you first go into St. Louis, Jerry?
When I was in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Started going there then. All the guys didn't get to go. I was one of the fortunate ones.
When Murdoch was in there, did they ever have him with Adrian Adonis as a team in St. Louis?
No, not that I know of. No, not when I was there.
Yeah, I know they had a good run in New York together. I knew they were in St. Louis at different times, you know, together, but I never knew if they teamed them up there or not.
Wait a minute. Yes, they did too. Yes, they did because me and Jannetty worked with them. That's when the whole. The wrestling business had come to a halt. You know, that's when McMahon had snatched up everything. And then I don't know if you guys know Larry Manizak or not. Do y'all know him?
Yeah. Never been able to talk to him on the phone a lot of times.
Oh, what a nice man. So Larry, you know, he had ties there in St. Louis, of course. So he started running, and he called me and asked me, was I interested? And I said, shoot, yeah, I'm interested. And so I went in there. He had some good talent, man. He had some good talent. Lasted for a while, you know.
The best thing I can say about him was how smart he was to have the vision to keep all the tapes. Because,
did he,
you know, he's put out 13 DVDs and maybe more to come of the best of St. Louis, and it's great quality, great stuff. He's got stuff all the way back to '67 that I've
really?
Seen. and just, man, he puts them together. He does a little opening and just talks about what was going on in St. Louis then. He put the full Mushnick retirement show out. I mean, he kept everything. Even the press conferences, the party they had for Mushnick after he retired. I mean, he's put together some great DVDs from St. Louis. And like I said, the quality of most of it is just like watching it on TV now.
Well, I'll be dog. He was a nice man. That wasn't a nicer guy than Larry Mamzak.
Yeah.
I thought the world of him.
I liked the way he commentated the matches. I mean, I thought he was very good. And if you lived outside of St. Louis, you never saw him. You know, I wasn't familiar with him until I started getting those DVDs. And, man, he's great.
Larry was a good guy.
I communicated with him when, you know, working in the office with Barnett, when he was working for Mushnick or with Mushnick, you know, sometimes I would communicate with him whether they wanted a tape or they needed something or we needed something. But I always had a pretty good rapport with him over the phone. But
he was just first-class guy.
His name just slipped me. He did the baseball games too, but he was there before. He was when they first started doing wrestling at the Chase. Gergiola. Did you meet him? He came back from time to time.
His brother Mickey did the ring announcing.
He's on all those DVDs.
Yeah, Mickey was a good guy. He was funny. He was a good guy. But I never met Joe. Joe was never around when I was there.
Yeah, he went to work for NBC doing the sports, I guess, early 70s one.
He was very good.
There's a few with him calling the matches, some early 60s, mid-60s stuff on those with him calling them.
I have seen him doing that. Where I saw it, I don't know, but I have seen him or heard him. Or, you know, I was watching matches that he was calling. He was good.
Yeah. Do you know who the very first guy was to call the action in St. Louis?
No idea.
Harry Carey.
Are you kidding me?
No, that was his first job, and he did them on the radio, and then when they first went to TV, he did them on TV too. And then he worked there during the winter months, and he worked for the Cardinals in the summer months before he went to Chicago with the Cubs.
Hey, guys, my time to duck out for a phone call. I'll be right back.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah. And Jack Brickhouse, who was the original voice of the Cubs on radio and TV, he did the wrestling matches in Chicago for years.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't know if they were fans or they just used them because they had the celebrity from the ball games, you know. But I've got a book in here from 1955. It's called Wrestling Around the Country, and it's got who all had TV and who the commentators and stuff, and almost every one of them was a baseball announcer. Brickhouse, Harry Carey, because it'll have like the side notes of what else they do. And then Bill Mercer in Dallas, he was the local newsman. He did the wrestling there for years in Dallas.
I love listening to Harry Carey when he was doing the Cubs.
Oh, yeah.
I loved him. I didn't care for his son.
Yeah, he found his niche in Atlanta and stayed there forever. I think
but I didn't
remember the story about him.
he was always, you know, he had a call-in show at one time. He was so rude to people that called in. And
yeah.
It was like it was beneath him to talk to him or something. I didn't care for him. I really didn't.
Yeah. I like it. I like Harry's grandson Chip. He does the Braves now. I listen to him. He started. Yeah, he passed. I guess 4 or 5 years ago.
I thought he did. I just didn't care for him.
Yeah, he was. He did the Braves game probably from the time they came to Atlanta to when he passed. He might even been with them in Milwaukee because he was around a long time. When you was in St. Louis, did you ever the football players and the baseball players ever come to the matches?
If they did, I don't know that they did, Bo. I really don't know. I know I used to listen to WKMOC radio coming into St. Louis.
Yeah.
And Jack Buck worked for them. I love Jack Buck. What a voice he had.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His son's really good, too. He does the Fox Game of the Week.
He is very good. And he said, I was like 45 minutes out from St. Louis. He said, if you plan on going to the Kill tonight, stay away. It's sold out. I'm thinking, all right.
Yeah. That St. Louis was special, wasn't it? I mean, it was different than anything else in the country.
I have no idea what it was like. It was.
Yeah.
It was. It's what it should have been. It was. I wrestled in a lot of towns that was close to that, you know, but that was not that big. Like Columbia, South Carolina was like that. It was unbelievable, Columbia. It was just the building, it was kind of like the building in Augusta, kind of, you know. It was just suited, like it was made for wrestling, you know, and the fans there were just, no matter what you do, they'd get into it.
Y'all talking about me again?
Yeah, we are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm back.
So many buildings like that, Jerry, that they're not even standing anymore. I mean,
that's so sad. It's sad.
George South told me, he said, you know, the Park Center there in Charlotte, and then it became the Grady Cole. And it's named something else now. He said the only thing they do there now is park cars there for the football games next door.
Where is that?
In Charlotte, where they ran every Monday night for decades.
Isn't that something?
They're going to tear the Mid-South Coliseum down in Memphis. The Louisville Gardens is going to be tore down. They're getting right there. The old rec center here in Johnson City down. I mean, there's just so many.
How long did they tear that building down in Memphis?
It's the craziest thing. Memphis has always wanted a professional sports team. They had USFL teams. They didn't work out. They made a bid when the Expos was leaving Montreal. They tried to get them, and Major League Baseball said, well, you got a Triple-A team here in town. You don't even support it, so how are you going to support a Major League team? They tried to get, when the Titans came to Nashville, they tried to keep them, and they played the first year in Memphis, and they tried to keep them down there at the Liberty Bowl, but it's out of date. So they got the Grizzlies. When the Grizzlies, where were they, Vancouver, I think, or somewhere, the Grizzlies NBA team come to Memphis, and the deal was when they came, they had to build them a new building. They built the Forum, FedEx Forum, right downtown, and every event that comes in there, they book it themselves. So you got the Pyramid, which is, I think it was built in 92 or 93, and now it's a mall. They turned it into a shopping mall. And the Mid-South Coliseum sitting over there for $4 million, they can bring it up to code, bring everything up to date, and use it. But they're going to tear it down and haul it off for $30 million. It makes no sense.
I've wrestled in that building. How many is this seat, Bo?
Well, it depends on if they had the stage or set up. Anywhere from 10 to 13,000, just depending on how they had it set up. If they had the extra risers out, if they had the extra seating out.
Right, right.
You know, but that's what a building.
That makes no sense, none whatsoever, does it?
No. Same thing in Louisville. That Louisville Garden's been sitting there empty. Still a great building. They could use it for all kinds of stuff, and they won't. You know, and it's happening everywhere. You know, and it's a shame. It's part of our history that will be gone forever. You know, and you got Boutwell in Birmingham. It's still there, but I don't know how much it's used.
What the Boutwell?
Yeah, the Boutwell Auditorium. You know, it's there, but I mean, there's not many of the old buildings that are still standing. The Tupelo, Mississippi, where they ran there, Goulis and Jarrett ran there every Friday night forever. That was the sports arena. It's now an ice house. They make bagged ice there. That's what they do in that building now.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And it just, you know, $4 million compared to $30 million for the Coliseum in Memphis makes no sense. You know, the fair's already moved out of there. It moved, Mid-South Fair moved outside of Memphis. So all the buildings around here are down. They're supposed to build a new Liberty Bowl, so I guess they'll tear the original Liberty Bowl and the Coliseum down and build it right there. I don't know how they're going to do that.
Well, if you guys would like to relocate a 72,000 seat dome, I make him negotiate a deal for y'all in 2017. Well, they're just
yeah,
going to implode it, is what I understand.
They go jack your tickets up, something off.
They just hired an architecture firm out of Kansas City and paid them $35 million just to design the place.
Hell, I got a legal pad. I can draw them up something
yeah,
cheaper than that.
Tell me about it. You ought to see some of the concepts they showed.
Oh, Lord.
You know, you look at all them stadiums they built in the 70s. All them cookie cutters, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, gosh, who else? I mean, they had
Atlanta,
them all.
St. Louis, Philadelphia.
Yeah, Atlanta's, none of them are standing. They went bigger and better, and they got away from what they had, got away from the atmosphere that they had in all them old parks. And it's the same thing with all the old wrestling buildings, you know.
But you know the only one that's left is Wrigley Field.
Yeah. They just started this offseason, a 5-year, they're going to have to remodel, not remodel, but they're going to do a lot of work to the brick because the brick's starting to fall down.
There's a story in the USA Today, or was it USA Today, or did I see it online? The owner of the Cubs said if they don't do some stuff to block the views from those roofs where those people are watching the games free,
yeah,
that they're going to move, which they ain't ever going to move. But he said they're going to have to renovate that stadium.
I'd put me up some tarpaulins or something, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's 100 years old, you know, and it needed. I don't want it to change, but they had to change what they've done. I mean, or it was going to fall down. But people were throwing a fit because he put a couple advertisements on the wall out there.
Well, you
he's got to compete.
They went crazy when they put lights in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, they want him to win, but they're going to cut his revenue where he's not going to have the money to compete if he can't sell the advertisements. You know. It's hard to compete with the Yankees and the Braves and everybody else that's got billions of dollars. And
well,
don't mind spending it.
You're talking about everybody's going bigger and better. The Braves actually went smaller.
Is that stadium smaller than Fulton County?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, come on, Bobby.
Fulton County held, for baseball, held 52,000. This stadium over here won't hold but about 48,500, maybe 49 if it's packed.
Well, where's the logic?
Well, it's a much more, I don't know, the thing is now when they're building these stadiums, if they're trying to make them look like the old stadiums and give them some character,
yeah,
rather than just having, you know, the round cookie cutter design that they all came up with. And, of course, the Braves got a pretty good deal because, you know, that was the Olympic Stadium. You know, it was an old, big, old, an oblong oval, and, you know, they ran the track and field and all of that. And then when the Olympics left, they went in and tore out one end of it and configured it to become a baseball park. So.
Yeah, but they got stuff in. They got the restaurants and all that stuff in there that they didn't have in Fulton County.
Right, they got restaurants. They got more private boxes, which is the big deal. That's like Phillips Arena. They tore down the Omni, seated 18,000 people. You know, for wrestling, we could put 18,000 in there. For hockey, it was 16,000. Basketball, probably 16,500 something. But now they built Phillips Arena. Phillips Arena holds about the same amount of people, but one side of that arena is all private boxes. That was the whole deal, was to get, you know, they're generating more revenue by having the private boxes.
What do those things go for?
I have no idea. I know a box at a Falcon game is like $35,000-$40,000, depending on where you are, you know, in relation to the field.
Who's got that much money to watch a football game?
Bobby, have they said what the tickets will go up when they get the new one?
No. No. We heard private seat license or PSL might come into play. And I told the guy that goes with me,
that.
I said, if they do that, I'm not going because I'm not paying it. One of the concepts they came up with yesterday was, my seats are on the corner of the end zone in the upper deck, and I originally had 50-yard line seats, and they kept going up and up and up and up and up, and then Blank bought the team, made them seats in the end zone $100 for the whole season. I told them to move me. So, but I heard yesterday one of the concepts they came up with was no seats in the upper level end zones because they want to have a clear view of the downtown skyline. Now, that's got a lot to do with the product on the field, but, you know.
Well, you're trying to run a football game, not a scenic tour.
Well, they keep talking about the my wife's telling me we're really talking wrestling tonight. Yeah,
they keep talking about the game day experience.
You know, the game day experience. They got the carnival going on outside, the tailgating and all this other. You know, I go to watch football games. Maybe I'm the oddball in the whole thing scheme of things here, but I go to watch the football game. I'm more concerned with the product on the field than I am the Ferris wheel setting up in the parking lot.
I would think so.
And something else too that I mean, and this, I know this is crazy. You never see a marching band at halftime anymore. They'll have my favorite halftime show the whole season, and they usually do it in the preseason. Is they have the dogs chasing the frisbees.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, one halftime show last year was some rap artist that I couldn't understand.
Right.
And nobody else could either. And, you know, people were booing him. And then they'll have some kind of deal for the Georgia Lottery. They'll have the cheerleaders dancing. It's just, I don't know. I just think we've gotten so far away from what the, you know, I used to say it about wrestling, you know, when the smoke and the music and all that stuff quits, you know, you still spell wrestling the same way.
Thank you.
You know, you got to have a product there. And I think it's the same thing with football. I just...
It's the same thing with all sports.
Yeah.
It seems like they try to make them bigger and more than what they are.
Yeah.
I watch baseball because I'm a baseball fan.
Exactly.
I watch football because I'm a football fan. I mean, I could care less about the halftime show and all that.
But you,
to me,
but
that
you know,
makes it longer.
Baseball really hasn't changed at all, really.
No.
It's one of the few sports that stayed the same. They doing so much of football now. You keep doing all that helmet stuff. And
in 5 years, it's going to be two-hand touch on the quarterback.
You're talking about baseball. When I was a kid, you know, I grew up maybe 2 miles from Atlanta Stadium. When I was a teenager, you know, it was nothing for a bunch of us to walk to the stadium to a ball game and walk home after it was over. You could get a general admission seat if you were over 12. A general admission seat back in the 60s, 70s was a dollar, dollar and a half.
You kidding me?
No. When I was a kid under 12, I remember getting in for 50 cents. You know what
you can't get a Coke for that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know what the average ticket price is for an Atlanta Braves game is now?
I have no idea.
Take a guess.
$25.
You're close, $28. Now, how do you, they complain because people don't go. How do you afford that?
Here's what I don't understand. You have a four-game home series. Who can go every night?
Oh,
yeah. And you sure can't take your family every night.
How's it going grow now, Bobby?
Last night they had, when did Hudson win his 200th? 2 days ago? They had 19. He was going for his 200th win, and they drew 19,000.
And they played who?
Washington Nationals.
Oh, yeah, they're playing them tonight, too.
Yeah.
Well, the subject I have tonight is the lost art and things that we miss. So this 30 minutes of talking sports kind of fits right in with what we're going to talk about in the wrestling scene.
Yes, it does.
We probably could do a 5-hour show tonight on this subject. So I'm going to take this first break. When we come back, we're going to start talking about some wrestling.
All righty.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling Television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the show to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Still got both of you with me?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
We've made it 37 minutes without any technical problems this week, so I think that's a record for the last month. Well, as we were talking about everything that seems to change, and we all know the wrestling profession has changed since the mid-80s in leaps and bounds. You know, some say good, some say bad, but there's a lot of stuff that's missing, and there's a lost art to a lot of things that no one seems to have a grasp or a hold of. And the first one I want to talk about is the lost art of tag teams. Ben, with both of you worked with some of the greatest teams in the history of our business. You know, there's no teams anymore. And not on a national level, not on local independent cards in your local towns. I mean, they have tag team matches everywhere, but there's not, you know, teams like the Assassins or the Kangaroos or the Oates Brothers or we could name countless many more.
You know, that the key to that is, in my opinion, of course, when Ted and I were together, I mean, who dropped the fall or took the fall, we could care less. That had nothing to do with, we didn't care, you know. But the key to a great tag team match or a team is a team that can lead the whole thing, you know. There's so many guys that, I mean, it was like Tom and Jody. I mean, they were masters. I mean, they control that whole situation. Yeah, it's you can take just say Ted and I and get in the ring with two guys that had, you know, a couple of years experience that had a clue anyhow. You could and if they could work, you could have a great match with them. There are no leaders out there, you know. That's the whole thing, I think.
Yeah, it's hurry up and get my stuff in, and I'll tag him in and let him do what he wants to do. And they don't,
exactly.
they don't work as a team. They don't. And speaking of this, I've been meaning to tell you this for the last few weeks, Jerry. On YouTube, I come across a match with I think it was you and Tommy Rich with your brother and Rip Rogers. And Rip Rogers, it was a sixth man. It was Bob Roop, your brother, and Rip Rogers with you, Tommy Rich, and Jerry Lawler. And Rip
right.
Rogers commented on that video. He said two of the most underrated and most professional guys that he ever worked with was you and Bob Roop. He said zero ego and always worked hard to get their opponent over as much as the match over.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I thought when I read that, I thought what a great compliment that was. And but yeah, it's a lost art. I mean, I was so fortunate growing up. I got to see every from the Assassins to you. I mean, you name it, we all got to see them, and you guys got to work with them. And I mean, as the history books being wrote by the people that lasted the longest now, they're going to be lost in the shuffle.
Well, Bobby Simmons has seen some great tag teams because he was in there with them.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. and as far as the tag teams, and you're talking about Tom and Jody and Crapoli and Gene were masters at what they did. And Bowman and Turner, there's another two. Whether they worked as the Sky Brothers or the interns or as Bowman and Turner. Another great team that just they knew what they were doing. There was no ego with those guys either. I think that's the key. I watched it Saturday night, Jerry. We were up at Blue Ridge for that George Grable benefit, and they had a tag match up there with these two. And I don't know who they were. I have no clue. But the babyface team, I mean, the heels were getting their heat on this kid, and I don't know who he was. But all of a sudden, he'd come up with, and then Bo was standing there watching it with me. He would all of a sudden come up with some spectacular move, and then he'd start throwing punches, and then he'd just die again. I mean, he made his own comeback three or four times. He hit the guy with a super kick that should have ended the match. And all of a sudden, he reaches over and tags his partner. When he tagged his partner, the people just sat there. There was no hot tag to it.
If he'd have tagged me, I said, what do you need me for?
Yeah, my point exactly. But, you know, the poor kid in the ring, as bad as I wanted to say, hey, what are you doing, he probably don't know no better.
He don't, Bobby. But, see, guys that was in there with him, you can hold them responsible, too.
Yep.
That's right, because they let him do it.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
That's exactly right. And They don't understand the art of building to that hot tag to get that big pop. I mean, it's out of desperation. And the thing, too, that I see, and I see this every weekend, there's like one of three ways that they all go to the hot tag now. There's hundreds of ways you can make that hot tag. But they all repeat what they see. And it's a lost art. Of having a tag match.
You know, you go out there and you got to have a feel for it. You've got to have some psychology. One of the craziest tag matches, it wasn't crazy, it just turned out this way. That's the night the guy gave my shirts away, right? We went to Wichita, Kansas. It was sold out. We'd done this deal with Ted. And that was Ted's town. He was over, like, I don't know, everybody had a town. That was Ted's town. He was over. So he'd been gone. He was out a month. He heard, you know, we did a deal. We heard his show. He was in Japan and blah, blah, blah. We built it up the whole time he was gone. So when we come back, the place is sold out. Ted Oates, the Oates brothers go wrestle. Ed Waskowski and Tank Patton. The place is sold out. So we're on last. We go out there, and Waskowski's the one that had done the damage to Ted's shoulder in Wichita, right? So I told Ted, I'll start the match. He said, okay. And it never turned into a tag match. I went out there, and I did my thing. Boom, they stopped me. I stayed in the ring about 40 minutes. They kept telling me, tag Ted. And I had stayed too long at a point. It wasn't right. You know, you could feel it. And I was fighting. I said, whatever you do, don't let me tag my brother. I was doing everything. I was pushing them, doing everything, trying to get to him. But, see, you can overdo that too, right? And I kept on and kept on and kept on and it had them as high as I could get them, as high as I could get them. And we did something when Waskowski and I was in there, and I said, I'm getting ready to make the tag. And Ted was working that apron. He was soaking wet, working that apron, working that apron. And when I finally tagged him, I tagged him. I said, it's your time. Go do your thing. And I was laying on the apron, holding the second rope, watching it. But when he hit that ring, those people went absolutely berserk. He must have made a 10-minute comeback on him. They fed him, boom, 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 boom. He finally beat Waskowski, 1, 2, 3, and then people went. But I never come back in for a four-way. That was his thing.
Yeah.
And see, somebody would have got up and turned and got into a four-way, but I, this was his thing, and they kept telling me to tag him. When we got back upstairs, they said, you were right, man. If I'd have tagged him, he'd come in and did a thing, then we'd have to start all over again.
Yeah.
It was just one of those,
right.
That never happened before or since. It was just one of those things, and it was right, you know. But,
you know, work in the apron. You tell somebody that now, that's another thing. That's a lost art. They have no idea what you mean.
Tighten up some stuff or something. That's what you're talking about.
They're not fluent, Bobby.
And I told them, and they wanted to do a false tag. I never made a false. That would have killed it.
Yeah.
You know, that would have killed it. This guy
took the heat off them, putting on a referee.
There you go. See, the whole thing was, He's had a dislocated shoulder, and he was out for a month, and blah, blah, blah. If I'd have done that, that would kill the whole thing. You couldn't do that again in 100 years. That was just one of those nights. It was right. It was just unbelievable. But it takes, to have a tag match, you got to have four guys, but you got to have at least two that knows what they're doing.
Yeah. And there's no leaders. They don't want to be led now, you know, and that's not just what I see. I see that everywhere, but, you know, I hear about it from people that watch the national products, too, and it's just, let me get my stuff in, and I'll tag out. I mean, it's a lost art.
You just said it right there. I've got to get all my stuff in, whether it's right, the time's right, or wrong, they got to get it in.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the whole problem.
You used a word a few minutes ago that I think is another thing that's lost in our industry. It's psychology. There isn't any anymore. You know, guys are not, you know, promoters are out there trying to take a few bucks in on a show. They're not interested in coming back in 2 weeks. They don't plan to come back in 2 weeks, or maybe they do, but they don't know how to do something to spark interest to get the people to come back. They're just concerned with what's there now.
Here's the whole thing. I don't mean to interrupt you, Bobby, but you nailed it on the head. Ernesto, I never forget him saying one night, we got a packed house. Now what do you do? What do you do to get them back? You know, you say, oh, we got a packed house. Great. You got to get them back.
You got to get them back.
I don't know. There's no way that either one of these two big companies that are running could run a town every week. It'd be impossible.
They couldn't do it every month. They couldn't do it every month. And the thing, too, and there's no emotional connection with, you know, I grew up, Crockett ran here in Kingsport every other Sunday. During that big run that Sergeant Slaughter and Don Carnoodle had with Steamboat and Youngblood, there was that connection with the fans. The people wanted them, Steamboat and Youngblood, to win. I mean, they were our hometown heroes. We had an emotional connection to them. And when they finally won, they drew the biggest house they ever had in Greensboro when they finally built to that thing. But they don't have that connection now because they tell everybody it's a show. It's this. It's that. You know, there's a difference. When I was a kid, wrestlers were our hometown heroes. They were our sports stars here.
Oh, sure they were.
I mean, and we all had our favorites. We were all connected. Now, there's no territories, and there's some guys that do pretty good in the towns they got where the people are connected with what they. Woody does a good job in Blue Ridge. I mean, the people, for what he's doing there, the people do get connected to his guys. And same thing here in a few other places, but they don't have that. You know, if you go to see a national event, you're going to see Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. They bring everything once or twice a year. You see it all in one night, and then they go on to the next place. You don't have that connection to where you would come week after week or every 2 weeks to see your heroes win. And that is another lost art of being able to do that interview, being able to have that match, and be able to go back and do another interview to bring them back 2 weeks or next week. You know.
Bobby, how often does New York come to Atlanta?
Maybe twice a year.
Twice?
Yeah, maybe. Twice, maybe three times is a stretch, but a couple times I'd say.
Well, where do they go, Phillips Arena?
Phillips. Well, they've run Phillips, and they've also run the Gwinnett Center, which is up north side of Atlanta. It's about a 10,000-seat venue.
Do they
normally
fill it up?
They're Phillips.
Do they fill them up?
You know, I'd like to say I really don't know. I really don't know.
They're going to be here soon. I don't know when they're going to be here. I don't know.
Civic Center's still there? They still run that same building?
Yeah. Still there.
I was in Columbus on Monday. First time I'd been to Columbus in I don't know how long. And I had Randy with me that worked in the office with me. And we went downtown. And I ain't never been so heartbroken in my life when I got to 1028 Front Street and saw a parking deck.
Is there a parking deck now?
About a three-story parking deck. And
well,
it's 1028 is emblazoned on it. It's etched into the concrete. So, I mean, I could tell where I was, but it just... And then riding down that street and seeing that Coliseum down there instead of that old auditorium, I just...
When they tore the sports arena down where we did TV on Saturdays?
Uh-huh.
That's where I went. That's the only place they had when I was a kid. That's where we went to wrestling.
Right.
But when they was tearing that building down, I rode by there and they were tearing it down. I said, oh, man. So I pulled up in the parking lot and there was a guy on a tractor. And I got out of the car. He looked at me. He said, I know who you are. I said, look, I'd like to get something from here. He said, you can get anything you want. So I got some kind of sign, like an RC Cola sign that was in the concession.
Uh-huh.
And I got me about 15 bricks, and I still got them.
Hmm.
Bobby, if those walls could talk,
George
had been in there, the Bruiser, Snyder. Everybody had been in that building. Every world champion. I mean,
that's the way Johnson City, that the old rec center up there on Legion Street, it's 72 or 73 years old. They just built a new one right behind it. So it's only a matter of time before they take it down. And I went there every Tuesday night for years. That was the Knoxville office would run that. And then Crockett ran Kingsport, so six times a month they was wrestling here in the Tri-Cities. So, and both of them doing business. And when that building comes down, I'm going to be the same way. I'm going to go up there and get some bricks.
That's what I did, Bo.
I've got some from the Huntington Field House in West Virginia. They tore it down last year. I got three bricks from there. So, same thing, if they do tear the Memphis Coliseum down, I'm going to make a 500-mile trip to get something from there.
It don't mean nothing but something to you.
That's it. Yep, that was my dream as a kid watching Jarrett's TV out of that building. You know, they'd show clips every week. I wanted to wrestle there. And the first time I got to work there, man, I was a nervous wreck. So, just thinking, like you said, think of everybody that's been in those buildings. Oh, man.
I'm sitting here looking at I have a little curio cabinet here in my living room. And I'm sitting here looking at it. I've got the little models you get of the stadiums that, I don't know what you call them, they're little miniature models of the stadium. I got a miniature of Atlanta Stadium. And the day they imploded it, I rode downtown, and I've got a piece of the rock, a piece of the brick from the Atlanta Stadium. It's, I'm sitting here looking at it.
Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah. I just, you know, I mean, what can you say? We're just sentimental babies. That's all it is. You know. Going back to the tag team thing a second. You know, you mentioned the false tag. You know, I used to get in more arguments with guys because they would want to do that 3 or 4 times during a match.
It don't mean nothing, Bobby.
And I used to tell them, I'll give you one. I said, I'll give you one. I said, but we're not doing this 3 or 4 times, you know, because – It takes all the heat off the heels. It puts it right on, you know, the referee ain't going to draw
right
it.
Right on the ref.
And it puts it right on the referee. You know, I mean, you can be stupid one time by mistake, but you can't do it 4 or 5 times.
Yeah. And that's another lost art right there, the referee. And I see guys every week just bury the referee in every town. I see heels put their arms around the referee and turn them around. And the ref lets him.
Huh.
I said, if you were to walk up, grab a major league umpire and turn him around, what would happen? You know, if you should do that to NFL official, what would happen? and they don't get that. And the same thing would turn around and ask the people. They do this, do that. I said, once they answer you, you're done. You've buried yourself because you didn't do anything about it. You know, there's no umpire turning around asking the people, was that fair or foul? You know. The NFL's not asking, was that a touchdown? Was he inbounds? I mean,
Let me tell you something, Jerry. I saw a referee do Saturday night, and I was I don't even know who he was, and I was proud of him. These two guys is in the ring working, and the heel has a headlock on this guy. I don't know if he was heel or babyface. It doesn't matter. He hip locks him and takes him over in a headlock. I say hip locks him. He took him over in a headlock and covered the guy. And the guy and the referee went down and went 1, 2, and he delayed for just a split second, and the guy didn't kick out, and he went 3.
Thank you.
It's the first time I've ever seen a guy get beat in a headlock being taken over. And then
my headlocks are deadly, Bobby.
Yeah, I'm telling you. This guy Bo was in the ring with Saturday night. I wouldn't want to have been in there with him with a gun. He didn't know his elbow from his nose. And he told the referee, he said, well, I hurt my head. No, he said, what did he say? He said, Misty hit him in the ear, and he said, yeah, I was trying to get my bearings, and I thought you'd let me lay here a minute.
Well, I wrestle a long time, and I wrestle in a lot of places. I mean, in a lot of places. And there's only 4 referees that stick out in my mind. And one of them's on this show tonight. The other one is Ronnie West. The other one was Tommy Young. And the other one was Stu Schwartz. And those are the 4 best that I've ever been around. And they were all so good, I couldn't say who was 1 and who was 2. That's they were the same. They were the greatest referees that I've ever been in the ring with.
Stu Schwartz is a guy that most wrestling fans don't even know who Stu Schwartz is now. They know Tommy Young from the stuff they play on the Wrestling Channel now and a few others. But, yeah, Stu Schwartz was great.
Yeah.
Those 4, and I wouldn't put one ahead of the other. That would be impossible. That's how good they were to me.
That's my opinion.
That's a fact.
You know, you name off, you know, all 4 of us were different, too.
All 4 of you were different?
Yeah. You know, Ronnie West was a spark plug. And a lot of the stuff I did, I learned from Ronnie. I watched Ronnie. I thought he was the best I'd ever seen. Stu Schwartz was good, but Stu was totally different. Stu paced himself. Stu usually had a better tan than the boys did.
He did. He looked good.
Looking. Yeah, he carried himself very well. And I remember one time in Atlanta, right after Briscoe took the title, and they were running the circuit with him and Funk doing the rematches all over. They did a deal here in Atlanta where they said we're going to have a special referee. The NWA is going to appoint a special referee, and we don't know who it is. And Stu. Stu bought a ticket and come in and sat at ringside, wore a trench coat and sat at ringside the whole night. And they brought Gordon in to do the announcing, and Gordon said, would the referee make himself known at this time? And Stu got off third row, walked up, took his coat off, and climbed in the ring. And nobody knew who he was, but that was...
But it meant something.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And
see, they could have flown you to St. Louis. Like, we're bringing in a special, one of the top NWA referees in the whole country, blah, blah, blah. That, just doing that, that puts, like, intrigue and suspense to the whole thing, you know?
Put some importance on it.
Exactly.
Bobby, or Jerry, in St. Louis, they had the two referees. Was that the only place... That's the only place I've ever seen that. Is that for the tag matches? Did you ever see that anywhere else?
No.
Yeah. Why was that done that way?
I have no earthly idea.
Yeah.
We did it working for Gunkel in 73 and 74.
Did you?
Sure did. Sure did. We used two referees. That was for tag matches. That was a whole new process to learn.
Yeah, watching the DVDs of St. Louis with the two referees, I mean, you just, because you got to be careful not to bury the one standing on the outside watching you.
See, we were both in the ring.
They had one in the ring and one on the apron.
We both worked in the ring in Atlanta when we did that.
That's just the only place you did it in Atlanta.
We did it for Gunkel. Anywhere Gunkel. Yeah, well, yeah, I'd say in Atlanta was probably the only place because it had to be a show big enough to have two referees to do it.
Right.
We might have done it in Columbus. I can't remember. But that was I remember Jody Hamilton decided, Sky High Clark that I mentioned over here a couple weeks ago, Jody, they had him as a special referee in a tag match, and I was the other referee, and Jody decided to bury him. So, Jody, you talk about touching a referee, Jody grabbed me by the shoulders, and he pushed me over the corner, and he looked at me, and he said, do not move. He said, do not move from this spot. Stand right here. And I went, okay. And the other guy, he didn't know what he was doing, so I thought, well, I got to go help, so I'd go help. And Jody got through doing what he was doing. He grabbed me by the shoulders again. He took me back over to the corner. He said, I'm going to repeat myself. Do not move. And what he was doing, he was helping throw the last couple of shovels of dirt on the career of Sky High Clark. But, it was working two referees in the ring plus four guys. You talk about a four-way, and then you got two referees in there, too. It was tough to stay out of the way.
Especially if you had a guy like Ron Fuller in there when he took a bump, he covered half the ring.
As Len Rossi says, take a bump in stages.
I live by that. I tell you, another lost art is the manager. And there's, I guess Dutch is still with, New York right now, but, he's proof of just how much heat that he got because he got the mainstream media talking about him when he came back as a manager. But there's not been any kind of managers really that did their job in probably 20 years or more. And, Georgia was another one. Charlotte growing up, I got to see all the greats come through there too. They don't understand. The guys you see now, too, when I'm out here, they either do too much or they don't do enough at all.
Most of them want to do more than what the guys in the ring are doing.
Yes, they do.
When I was running in Columbus there, we'd have a manager, and I'd tell him, stay in your seat. Don't get up. You may do that for a month, but when he finally got up, he did something, and it meant something.
Yeah. Less is more when it comes to managing.
Thank you. I tell you, a good manager was J.C. Dykes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love J.C. Dykes.
Jimmy Dykes was a good fella.
Wasn't he, Bobby?
Yes, he was. You know, I had a chance. I worked with, well, you did too, Jerry. I know you sent him to. You know, Gary Hart, when he was not herbally medicated, was a good manager. Problem with Gary was he was medicated most nights.
Yes, sir.
Rock Hunter was a good manager.
He was a good manager.
Good manager. I never got a chance to work with Homer O'Dell.
I did early on here in Georgia when he was with Colt.
Colt, yeah. And Dandy Jack, I got to do some interviews with him when he come to work for, when he worked with Ann a little bit. I was trying to think who else we had in here. Gorgeous George Jr. was a good manager.
Who?
Gorgeous George Jr. They actually used him to manage some guys there near the end of his career.
Him and Archie Goldie together was great.
Him and Goldie was good together, yeah.
Yeah. Don Carson. Archie Goldie.
Don Carson,
yeah.
There's another one.
Didn't he just pass away?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, like Jerry said, most of them now, they want to be the center of attention. They want to get all the heat, and they want to get everything, and they bury the referee and the guy they're with.
Well, a manager was usually the guy's mouthpiece. The manager usually did the interviews. He would, they were generally good talkers. But the guys that Dandy Jack's a great example. Dandy Jack was a great talker.
What?
He didn't look like an athlete. He wore his tuxedo and he would sit in the corner and he toted a cane but El Mongo had the heat. I'm talking back in the '60s now. He had the heat, but when Jack would do something, it meant something. It was to save his man or to help his man in some way. But never did he do anything to take the heat off of the guy in the ring. Today, these guys want to blow whistles and beat on the ring, and
Sam Bass was a great one too. He would just sit there, just one time stand up and trip a guy, or slip lower the chain, and just like Jerry said, when they finally stood up, the whole building stood up with them.
There you go.
They saw it coming. And it wasn't 5 minutes. It might have been 5 seconds, but everybody saw it, except the referee, and they knew how to do it. These guys, they'll throw a guy on the floor now and go to kicking and stomping. They'll let the manager beat him half to death, and they're just holding the referee. They're burying him. So, I mean, they don't. It's a lost art. I mean,
it is.
So, we're all, what'd you say, Bobby, we're sentimental babies? we're all sentimental.
When we talked earlier today, Bo, you said you think we're just things we miss.
Yeah.
Not only lost art, but I got to thinking about that after I talked to you and as I was riding home today. And I don't know if this is the right word to use or not, but I miss the sanctity of the dressing room.
Yes, that I was getting ready to get to that.
The dressing room was our haven. I mean, it was where we went, and it wasn't. We didn't always. Everybody wants to dress together because you got to go over 15 moves you're going to do.
Not me. I hide.
Well, the dressing room was where you went in there, and guys. Guys played, cribbage was the game of choice.
Here, let me read it to you. I got it right here. This is my list of things I missed. It was in my first book. Boys in the dressing room talking about everything but wrestling. We talked about everything. Sports.
Yeah, play, and you very seldom talk
cards,
about the business.
Read the newspaper. I mean, and we didn't have to worry about everybody and their brother and mother and sister and Papaw's cousin and everybody else coming in the dressing room. That drives me nuts.
Hmm.
Well, that wasn't done in our day.
No, it wasn't.
The other thing that drives me nuts now, people sitting in my chair. Oh. Oh.
I was a fanatic about that.
Oh, my bag sitting there, my ring jacket on the back, my towel in the chair, my bag sitting beside it, and they'll come sit right on my stuff or move it. Yeah. Ooh.
Well, we all, when Bobby and I were in our runs, I mean, everybody had their spot, didn't they, Bobby?
Yep.
Yep. And that's, I heard Bret Hart use it in one of the documentaries, but I heard Rick Connors say this years ago. He said the dressing room is like jail. The guy that's been there the longest has the best spot. He has the best seat, you know. And that's the truth. And you knew where everybody sit. You didn't have to worry about it. You didn't have to worry about nobody sitting in your chair or moving your stuff or no.
No, you wouldn't have done that but one time.
Yeah. Here's some other things that are mailing 8x10s to get booked. Nobody even knows what you're talking about if you said that now. I had a guy ask me a few months ago. He said, "How did you get booked before the internet?" And I thought, God.
Well, I wouldn't even know how to get booked off the internet myself.
I get emails every day, you know, guys, because they can email you a picture or video. They can do it all in an email now. And I used to go to the mailbox, and I'd have, mailbox be full every day, 8x10s or 4x6s and a videotape and guys trying to get booked. You know, long-distance phone calls, nobody knows about that. You know, calling cards.
We had, we used to laugh. You know, we would get, at the office, we'd get, we'd get pictures every day. And you could, and one thing you could count on, every picture that come in there, if it was from somebody you've never heard of, they were going to have a mask on and a belt. And it didn't matter. I mean, you know, the guys that you knew, you know, you got the old standard 8x10, and there was a note in there, hey, you got a spot for me, or, would like to come in, or however you wanted to word it. But, we'd get at least 10 or 12 a week of some guy with a mask on and some kind of belt, and you could tell by the way they talked in their notes or their letters or whatever, their resume that they would send, you could tell right away they didn't have not one clue what they was talking about.
Yeah, that's. I got to start forwarding you some of the emails I get. Let you look at them and read them. Oh, here you go. Six wrestlers in a car, 10 wrestlers in a hotel room, and a baloney blowout.
A baloney blowout.
That was Klondike Bill's favorite saying.
I've had a few of those. You know, I can't say that I ever had the 10 wrestlers in a hotel room. I was fortunate that, driving a ring truck, the office always took care of my expenses, so I was able to, get a room. Usually if it was me and Randy was on the road, we was able to get a room and it'd just be us. But
you never worked for George South then. Georgia put 15 in a room.
One guy registered and 14 go through the fire escape.
That's exactly right. Oh, you got a roof over your head and you dry. Take a shower in the morning. Signing a draw sheet. Nobody even knows what a draw sheet is if you tell them. No. Most of them ain't worried about getting paid, so they don't worry about signing nothing.
I miss the rides in the car.
That's still,
I don't miss the trips, but I miss the camaraderie and the riding.
Yep. that's one of I love riding in the middle of the night. Other than last Saturday, let me tell you, that trip home Saturday, whew, that Georgia 136 over to hit 441 back to Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
That thing should be a ride at Six Flags over Georgia, let me tell you. And with that storm that was coming through there, tree limbs falling across the road and on top of us and everything else, man. I was never so happy to get back on the four-lane road in my life.
Bo, how far are you from Atlanta?
I have about 4.5 hours from where I'm at.
About 3 inches on most maps.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm about 260, 270.
Okay.
To Atlanta. From my exit I live 2 miles off it. From there to downtown Knoxville, 81 miles.
You're 81 from Knoxville.
Yeah, 81 miles east. Yeah, that Blue Ridge, Georgia, unless you're coming south from Atlanta, there's not a good way in or out of that place. And it poured the rain all the way there and all the way home Saturday.
Where did you go?
How did we go? I came down through, I went to Asheville, then down to Silva, North Carolina, then down to Franklin, and then that way. But there was a spot of about 35 miles that I didn't see a house, a store, or one living being. So I didn't go back that way because I was not going to be out there at 1 o'clock in the morning. Something happened. So I came back. I came down below LJ and then cut across over to Chatsworth and come back up to Cleveland, Tennessee and hit the interstate there. So there's not an easy way to get in or out of that place. So but Bobby, that riding in the car and fixing this, I got that riding with a group of wrestlers in the car fixing the world's problems.
I was gonna say you can learn a lot if you just listen.
Yeah. And now they go to sleep as soon as they jump in the car.
You know, I was very fortunate to, yeah, and I was very particular about who I rode with and who rode with me. Call me fickle, but I made my mind up I wasn't going to jail for somebody else doing something stupid.
I know I wasn't.
So, you know, I made a lot of trips with wrestling too. Ronnie West, Bill Dromo. You know, I mean, guys that I knew that wasn't going to do nothing stupid, other than drink a 6-pack of ponies on the way home, and I made the mistake of riding with Billy Spears one time, and when I made it home, I thought, well, we won't do this no more.
And nobody still heard from him, right?
No, don't know nothing. No, somebody said, and I don't know who it was, somebody said that they thought legitimately he had passed away. But I don't, you know, nothing definitive.
He just fell off the map, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did. Boy, that guy and Roberto Soto had some matches here in Atlanta. Good gracious. That was a Renesto creation, that feud.
I really like to know about Billy. You know, I mean, I had some matches with him. I'd really like to know. He was from Jacksonville, wasn't he?
Right around Jacksonville, yep.
That's strange nobody's ever heard from him. But you think he's passed away?
Somebody said, and I don't remember who it was, Jerry, somebody told me, that they talked to somebody that was kin to him or something, and he had recently. They said recently. So, I mean,
was that his real name, Bobby? Do you know?
I think his name was William Spearman.
Spearman.
I think.
He's one of them that when you get out, you're either out or you're in, and he got really out.
Well, I'm wondering if that's the case. I'm wondering if when he got out, he just said, "Well, I don't want nothing else to do with it."
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to Joyce Saturday night about Vicki Williams, You know, Vicky, you ever run into her, Jerry? She still lives there in Savannah.
That's what I heard. But no,
she just totally, absolutely withdrew from the wrestling business, wants nothing to do with it. And, you know, I told Joyce, I said, I'd like to see her. She was always a pleasure to be in the ring with for me.
I knew she was, is she a preacher?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know. They said something about, they just said she decided she didn't want nothing else to do with it or be around the wrestling business or whatever, and she just totally withdrew. They said she's real active in her church, or that's what somebody said. I heard that, but I don't know with who or where.
Well, how long did Spears, when did he get out?
God,
when he left here, I don't know where he went.
I don't know either.
He was in, he worked for Jarrett in 86 or 87. That's the last place I remember seeing him.
Did he really?
Yeah, but it wasn't really long. Maybe like, you know, like three, he was managing Don Bass and Roger Smith, and it maybe 3 months, maybe a little bit longer than that. I mean, it wasn't a real long stay.
Didn't he legitimately mess up one of his eyes or something?
I thought he did.
I think he hurt. I want to say he messed up an eye some way. I heard, and he had to. He, you know, that's why, you know, he went to wearing a patch.
Well, that's strange.
You know, I'll have to look. I think he was wearing a patch when he was in Tennessee.
I bet he was.
I'll have to go back and look. I've got all the TVs from there. But like I said, he wasn't here a long time. But that's the last place I've ever seen him. And then just, you know, if you want out, you got to get so far that nobody can find you because they're going to suck you back in one way or the other. You know. Ask Tom Pritchard.
Ooh.
He yells at me all the time. I was out. I tell you the thing that you know, you're talking about the dressing room, but I just, you know, when I started, and I got in on the tail end of everything, but I just, even if you didn't like the guy, you had respect for him. You know, there was a sense of a unity in the dressing room. You know, I mean, there was a camaraderie among everybody. There's nothing like that now. You know, everywhere you go in the dressing room now, you got cliques sitting in this corner and that corner and over there, and, you know, they don't speak to anybody except the guys they rode in the car with to the town.
Well, this may be, I don't know if this is a good analogy or not, but you kind of, when you were in a dressing room, you kind of got the, you know, it was like us against the world at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're right, even if you didn't like a guy, and there was some guys that, you know, you just didn't care for, but inside that world, you know, I mean, that was our world, and I don't know, I miss that. I miss that. When I go, like, going to like that show Saturday night, I never went back in the dressing room. I had no desire to go back there. You know, and normally you... And, you know, guys that, you know, you was talking earlier about guys coming out watching the matches. You know, guys used to come out and watch each other's matches.
Yeah.
You know, you'd learn. I mean, if I'm on the second match, you know, I would always watch the guy in the first match because if they worked an arm bar in the first match, I didn't want to go out there and work an arm bar in the second match.
That's why I always make a point of asking the referee, what did they do in this match? What did they do in that match? And the ref looks at you like, why are you asking me? Who cares?
Your obvious answer would be they did everything.
Now it's got to the point where I don't worry about it because I know whoever was on before me didn't do anything I was going to do, and I'm not going to do anything they did. So I'm not diving to the floor or through the ropes. Or
I get hold of them now, go out on the floor, don't I?
It's almost every match ends up on the floor now. I had a guy tell me one time, he said, you can't get heat unless you go on the floor. I said, what?
I like the deal. I like the move they do where there's two guys on the floor and one guy goes across the ring and goes over the top rope or through the ropes outside and the two on, you know, and land on the two outside. You know, I always want to see somebody just as they wait till they get in the air and just kind of move.
I'll move in a heartbeat because just for the plain simple fact, why would you stand there and let a guy jump on you?
Well, that's my whole point. You're standing there watching the guy do this. Why would you stand there and wait? I mean, Mr. Oates' brother-in-law gave me some advice when I first started, and I've never forgotten it. He said, always work a shoot. He said, if you don't believe it, neither will they. And I'm not going to stand there and let a guy climb on the top rope. Well, that's like your wife's, the end of your wife's match the other night. I was going, God, move.
Yeah.
You know, it took that girl forever to climb up that rope. And I was like, I mean, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one phony punch, if there's one phony anything, then everything's phony. You know, because the people go, because they're looking for a reason to say, see, I told you. You know, don't give them that reason. Give them that doubt when they leave and they go, maybe I was wrong. You know, they don't. I don't know. But, you know, as kids, you had to have that belief, you know. Now, since everything is open and they've told people now for 20-plus years, well, it's a show, it's entertainment, they've never had that belief. There's never any time in their life that they've believed it. So why should they, they're not going to have a mind to understand the psychology or to get the fact of make people believe.
Is anybody drawing now, Bo?
You know, it's some people do, but I mean, they got to load up a card. I mean, they got to put a lot of money into it. And at the end of the day, was it worth it?
There you go.
It's so oversaturated everywhere you go. Dalton Chatsworth, Georgia, right there, and Eaton's right above it there. There's six or eight little promotions that run there every Friday and Saturday night within that 10-mile radius.
That's hard to believe.
You know, Nashville, same thing. Knoxville, same thing. Same thing here. Same thing in West Virginia. Carolinas is even worse. I mean, you can't go 100 yards without running into a wrestling ring in the Carolinas.
How many towns are you running?
Right now, nothing. I mean, I'd rather go work for somebody and get paid than be a mark that loses everything I own running the show. I mean, it's just got to, it's not worth it.
That's really sad. That's really sad, because I'm sure you know how to run a show. And
In the 90s, I was running as many as 12 to 18 days a month around here. But there was only me and one or two other guys that ran. Now, I mean, I saw a poster a few weeks ago for a card in Johnson City, and that's 20 miles from where I live. I did not know one guy on the poster. No idea who they were. So, I mean, that tells you something right there. There's that many people around here that are wrestlers. And it's oversaturated. Pretty much anything east of the Mississippi is oversaturated. Because it's too easy. Anybody can buy a ring and become a promoter. You know, it's enough. When I started and was a referee, as a kid, I would ask, you know, I want a pair of boots. I got a pair of boxing boots, but I want a pair of wrestling boots. And I'd ask, where can you get boots? They'd say, you don't need them. We'll tell you when you need them. You'll get them when we tell you. You know, they didn't want you to know. Straight you tell somebody. You know? But now, you do a Google search, you can have everything you need in 30 minutes. Except the know-how and the knowledge and the understanding. You can't buy that. You know.
No, you can't.
You're talking
about
posters.
Experience.
You're talking about posters, Bo. My wife went to eat the other day with her mom, and there was a poster in the window for a wrestling show, and she said, "Can I have this?" And she took it down and brought it home, and now I'm holding it. It's Platinum Championship Wrestling. For the unified title, the Jagged Edge challenges Supernatural. Now, this is for the unified title. Well, the picture of this Supernatural, he's got two belts on. So I can't figure out what they're unifying here. He's got both of them anyway. And then you got some woman here on here that says, "Miss Rachel to Supernatural, that belt is coming home with me." I have no idea who Miss Rachel is. Full action continues in the tag team season, whatever the tag team season is. Be there early to reserve your seat. Live at the Porterdale Main Event Center every first and third Saturday of the month.
And where is this?
This is in Porterdale, Georgia.
Porterdale, Georgia.
They're working in a storefront. You couldn't put 100 people in there on a bet with a shoe spoon and a can of lard. And Charlie Smith goes over and sells gimmicks. Now, for this particular card, he calls me on the way home that night. And he goes, "Bobby," he said, "I saw something I've never seen before." And I said, "What's that, Charlie?" He said, "The first guy comes out, this Jagged Edge, he weighs about 250 pounds. Said he looked pretty good." He said, "And then the Supernatural under a mask comes out with the two belts." And Charlie said, "If he weighed 125 pounds, he'd eat that building." And guess who walked out with the belts?
Little Man.
The Little Man. I told Charlie, I said, "Does he own the promotion?"
You see, there was made up names. They drive me crazy.
I can't stand.
When I was booking the Evansville Coliseum, and I took over, I asked one of the kids there, I said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Death PSI." That's what he told me. And I'm looking at him. He's, like you said, 125 pounds, 5'4". And I said, "What is your name?" He said again, "Death PSI." I said, "Look, buddy, I don't want your email address." I said, "What is your name?" I said, "There's nothing about you that says death other than malnourishment." I said, "What did your mother call you, Josh?" I said, "Your name is Josh." You know, they
don't get it. They don't get it.
No. There's always been gimmicks, and there will always be gimmicks, but there has to be believability to them. Tom Pritchard, me and Tom's on the card in, what's the name of that town? It's above Knoxville, right before you go into Kentucky. And this guy's in there, and he...
Will Follett?
No, it's close to there. It's a little bitty spot. It was another one of them two-car garages. I'm trying to think. But Tom asked the guy. He said, the guy's there, he's a little guy, skinny, wrestling in jeans and tennis shoes. He's got brass knuckles in his hands, showing them to everybody. And Tom said, "What's your deal?" He said, I'm a thug. That's my gimmick. I'm a thug. Tom said, "You still live home with your mom and dad?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You're not a thug. Go over there and sit down and shut up." I have this discussion with Eric Darkstorm. Him and Kyle Matthews, I think, are two of the best kids out there now. But I've told Kyle, too, the video game generation is what's in the wrestling business now. They want to do moves that they saw on video games or on TV. They don't want to work hard for it. It's entitled to them. It belongs to them. You know, Jerry, if you was to walk up to somebody your first 6 months in the business and start telling them, "Hey, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and this," how was that going to end up for you?
Yeah, just like you'd tell, if he was to tell me that now, it ain't going to happen, pal.
Yeah. I was telling Bobby today, my nephew asked me the other night about somebody. I know who he was, Bobby. It was Blade Boudreaux that comes to Mobile. And we was talking about him, and Jake asked me, said, "Where was the first time I met him?" I said, "The first time I ever met him was in Mississippi in the ring when we locked up with each other." And Jake said, "Well, you weren't worried?" I said, "No, because everybody then had a clue. They was with it. I'm worried now after I talk to guys before I go to the ring, like Saturday night." myself. It's
you sure get hurt, I'm telling you.
Well, it's if the inner Ole Anderson wouldn't have come out of me and grabbing that arm bar Saturday, yeah, I would have got hurt. And I was holding on for dear life.
I probably told you this, but I don't know if I ever tell you about the one and only time I ever worked with Bill Dromo.
I don't think so.
Charlie Smith run a town. He booked the town. This was after, you know, business was, you know, the office had shut down here. So he calls me and wants to know if I'll come work for him. And I said, well, yeah, who am I working with? And he said, Dromo. I said, yeah, I'll be there. So I went under a hood. And I walk in the dressing room, and I shook hands with everybody in the dressing room but Dromo. I didn't speak to him. And I went over and sat in the corner, and I never took the mask off. Got dressed, never said a word. He's sitting over there staring at me. I can feel him. And I ain't said a word. I ain't done nothing. Just keep sitting there. So finally, Charlie called us back in the shower, and he says, won't get the Dromo over. He's a local hero here. And I didn't say anything. I just nodded my head. And finally, when Charlie said, you guys can talk, do whatever, I finally told him. I looked up, and I said, here's what we'll do. I said, when we lock up, I'll rake your eyes. I said, I'll body slam you. I said, I'll shoot you in, give you a backdrop. I said, I'll drop an elbow, a couple of false finishes. He reached over and grabbed me by the T-shirt, and he picked me about 2 foot off the ground and shoved me into a locker. And he said, boy, here's what we're going to do. And I reached up, he used that mask up, and I went, it's me.
Yeah, you'd better have made that clear. Who
Listen, we locked up, and he shot behind me and rode me like a Shetland pony. I finally made it to the ropes. I told Charlie, the referee, and I said, Mr. Smith, would you tell Bill Gotts that this is a work?
Jerry, how many people did you meet for the first time when you locked up with them?
I didn't hear you.
I was asking Jerry how many people he met for the first time when he got in the ring with them.
Oh.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
I know the first time I hooked up, worked with Rip Rogers. Did you ever work with him?
Yeah, I know Rip a little bit.
Bo, did you ever work with Rip?
Yeah.
Bo.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, did you ever work with Rip Rogers?
Yeah.
He worked so light, right?
Oh, yeah. What a funny guy, too.
Yeah, I know the first time I got in the ring with him, I hooked up with him, he said, I don't work like that. I swear he did. I thought I was going to pee all over myself.
Oh, man.
The first time I ever worked with Frank Hickey, I hooked up with him, and he said, hey, kid, are you smart to the business?
That's the funniest line I've heard in a while.
They're only find this here on my list of stuff, because that reminded me of something, too. What was that? Here you go. Hearing in the things you don't hear in the dressing room anymore. Who won the ball game? Is there any talent out there? Do we have coffee? Got your sword, kid? Hey, are you with it?
If you used to ask them that now, they wouldn't know what you're talking about.
No, Jerry, I asked that guy Saturday. I said, because I was trying to calm him down, I said, tie up with me. Let me see something. He said, I'm not sure what that means, sir. I went and sat back out there at the table with Bobby. I'm fluent.
Jeez.
But it's really sad there's nobody there to help those guys or tell them or stay on them. Look,
that's the sad part.
That is. I'll say this about that kid. He is a really nice guy. And he wants it really bad. I mean, he wants to learn. Somebody took his money and told him he was a wrestler. He lives up in Boston or somewhere. And he comes down here just to get to work to try to learn. But he's so excited and so nervous and so you can't. Once it was over with and I went and talked to him, he's all right. But the majority of them, if you try to speak to them, they I've had 12 matches. I know what I'm doing. I mean, they're so arrogant and so uppity when you try to help them. You know, and
you said 12 matches. And I tell them, I've been body slammed 8,000 times.
One thing, and I tell everybody this, you know, I wish everybody had that experience to where they came back from the ring and a guy like Bill Dundee or Buddy Wayne or somebody was standing there and they said, hey, kid, come here. Because you know it wasn't going to be good. But they tell you. But, you know, they made you better.
They
helped teach
you.
You know, I can remember the referee coming and Dundee says, you're riding back to Nashville with him. Well, I knew. Well, that's 300 miles. I'm going to be cussed out. I have done something wrong.
But it
made me better, and it made me understand.
But back in the day, I mean, early on in my career, the referees would help you out.
Yeah.
They really would.
You know, when I worked in Memphis, you know, every one of those referees, Frank Morrell, Bill Rush, all them guys had worked for years. You know, like you said, they could help you. You got lost somewhere, they could tell you what to do.
But see, like this whole conversation we're having, is the whole, like you said earlier, it's just a lost art. I'm sorry. It really is. You know, these guys that run all these little towns and all, they watch New York and they watch TNA and they try to emulate what they're doing, and I don't know. I just don't know.
The majority of them, they want to work their 9-to-5 job, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they want to work their job, wrestle on Saturday, and have people come by their job during the week and tell them how good they did in the ring. Or they want to go to work and tell everybody that, I'm a champion because everybody's got a belt. You know, when I was talking about Evansville, when I took the book, started booking that town there, they were doing them light bulb matches and weed eaters and all that stuff. I mean, just the crazy. The first night I was there, when I went just to watch and work, they did a deal where they went out and the guy ran a guy over with a car. And then they fought back into the building, and he beat him with a small package.
Beat him with a small package.
He's tougher than I am.
Saturday, you'd probably have to run over him with a car to get him in a small package.
Oh, yeah. But I told him when I took the book over there, and I said, if your name is not on this sheet of paper, you're not working here anymore, I'll call you. And I hung a blank sheet of paper up. I brought a whole new crew in. And the first week we was there, there was about 16 people. And in 5 weeks, I got to 136, which ain't great. But I was doing five times what they were doing, and it was getting better every week. And the guy running the town came and told me. He said, there's too much of that Tennessee BS, too many old men on the card, and too much wrestling. My fans come for blood and guts. I said, you had 16 fans. I give you 136 wrestling fans. You was able to pay rent the last 2 weeks. But he didn't care, because what happened was all of these buddies that I ran off was his buddies that he played video games with all week. And they were all mad because they weren't getting to have their Weed Eater match or Light Bulb match that Wednesday night in Evansville.
What is Eater match?
They take each guy has a Weed Eater, and they just cut each other to pieces with it.
You're kidding.
No. And I told him when I hung a blank sheet of paper up, I said, this building's ran for 80 years. Dick the Bruiser, even before Bruiser, then Goulas, then Jarrett, everybody has ran this building. Same 300 Court Street, Evansville, the famed Coliseum. I said, you guys are mutilating your body. I mean, they were destroying themselves. Them light bulbs were going in their stomachs and their legs. I mean, it looked like a war hospital in that dressing room. For nothing. They weren't even getting paid. I said, you do this to go to your job with all these cuts and bruises on you, and people go, man, he's a big, tough wrestler. No, they're laughing at you because they're saying, why in the world would that guy do that and still have to come to work? He must not be making any money doing that.
See, they just told on themselves right there.
Right there. And when I get on these rants and some people will say, oh, I'm being negative, I'm not being negative. I've tried to use this show for the last 6 or 8 weeks, however long I've been doing, as an educational tool because I love the history of our business. I love our business.
Well, let me tell you something. If I went to a town and they pulled out a weed eater, I'd go absolutely blind.
Oh.
I've never heard. That's a new one on me. I'm just kind of shocked.
If that happened, I'd get Bobby to hold them while I weed eat them.
Jeez.
It's pitiful. It's and they think they're somebody.
Yeah. And it's just, when I grew up, there was nothing was going to stop me from being in the wrestling business. Nothing. I loved it. I wanted it. This is all I ever wanted. And I didn't want to do it to mutilate myself or do whatever, but we all got scars and we all got bruises. We've all had injuries. But I did it because I wanted to be a part of what I loved. I did it because I wanted to be a part of my heroes. I didn't care if it was a shoot, I was going to lose every night. I didn't care. I was going to be a wrestler because this is all I ever wanted to do. And I got so much respect for everybody that came before me and everybody that's worked hard and did it. And there's still some guys out there and girls out there that work hard and they try and they love this business and want to learn it. But that's the fight they're fighting. You know, how can you pay a guy to take a bumps and have a match when you're not paying people to cut themselves with light bulbs and weed eaters?
Well, what do they do with the light bulbs? I'm just mesmerized here.
You sound like me, Bobby.
They get those long fluorescent tubes. And we'll
okay, the 48 inches, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll tape them together and bust them over each other's heads or lay them down, suplex the guy on them, DDT them on them, whatever. They explode.
Why?
Because they think it's cool. They're hardcore. They're wrestlers. We're hardcore wrestlers.
Sounds like they're ignorant to me, but
I've always said that's an excuse for somebody that couldn't learn to work.
I can't
learn to work, so I'll just jump on something. I'll set myself on fire. Now the thing I see in the last few years is they take a staple gun and staple dollar bills to each other.
Oh, come on, man.
I'm telling you. It's a whole other world. I'm going to tell you, there's so many places that I go where I sit in the dressing room, and they'll pay me what I ask, and they'll take care of me. I mean, treat me like a king, but I won't go back just because I see that I'm not going to be associated with that. I sit there in shame thinking, man, I hope nobody knows I'm here. I mean, it's embarrassing. But there's...
Well, you've enlightened me to another world tonight, son.
Yeah. Oh.
I take it for the weed eater thing.
Oh, Bobby.
That's insane.
I mean, they take them to each other's arms and legs and stuff. Oh, my goodness.
Are you kidding me, man?
No,
listen,
I'm not.
Have you ever accidentally hit yourself with a weed eater?
Yeah, I have.
It hurts. Jeez. Listen, I'll tell you what dummy me did. And maybe we got another match here. I don't know. I was out here doing some pressure washing here last summer, and I thought, boy, that water just don't look like it's coming out there as fast as they say it is.
I know what you did.
And I reached out and just kind of let that thing fan across my hand. I took the skin off my fingers.
Yeah.
I won't do it no more.
Cut you right, old man.
And here again, yeah, and maybe we could have a pressure washer match.
They'd go for it. I'm surprised nobody had a chainsaw match.
Well, I'll tell you a story. Let me tell you a chainsaw story. And this was probably 17, 18 years ago when all the hardcore stuff, as they call it, first started. Me and Handsome Jimmy was in a little town in Kentucky, up around where it's on, not far from Evansville, but on the Kentucky side. And they had a casket match where they put two guys in. They were fighting to put the guy in the casket, close the lid, and you win. Then they had a guy come out with a chainsaw and cut into that casket. Well, he cut right into the guy in the casket.
Oh, come
cut
on.
Right into his arm. Oh, no. just brutal. But see, how did we go from headlocks, arm bars, and suplexes to weed eaters, light bulbs, and chainsaws? and it's not, and there's a market for it, because these guys that do these matches, some of them make pretty good money because they do the DVDs of them and sell that on the internet, and there's a market for it. I mean, we call them vampires. They just want to see the blood and guts. But you have no longevity in that. You're going to be 30 years old and just be nothing but a pussy scar from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. You know, and then what are you going to do? And I've seen, you know, the thumbtacks, the hitting each other with frying pans, everything you could imagine. But the thing that kills me is it all goes back to the finish is always a wrestling small package, sunset flip, something like that. And I said, you know, there's so much easier way to get to that small package rather than getting run over by a car. And it's not, you know, wrestling is so old, it's new again. And if you had guys that could go out there and tell a story, and the people's going to get with it. I see it places, you know, but the wrestlers were not wrestling fans that grew up on what we watched. And a lot of them, I don't know what they grew up on watching because they just, I don't know how they even got started. But, you know, that's the biggest thing. It takes all kinds to make up our business. But the main ingredient that is missing now is pro wrestlers.
Yep.
We don't have them. You know, they don't walk, and you guys understand this when I say this, they don't walk wrestler, they don't talk wrestler, they don't live wrestler, they're not a wrestler. You know, and everywhere you go, you meet some guy that says, well, I was the world champion, or I was this and that, and somebody believes him. And then they let him get involved in what they're doing. And they don't have a clue. And it's the biggest thing that I miss, and here we are talking about it on the show for anybody to listen to, but I miss when the cat was still in the bag.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Rick Connors told me when I was 15 years old, he said, you ever open your mouth, tell anybody anything goes on in here, they're going to find you floating in a river somewhere. And I believed him. And I still wait for people to wash up on the banks of the rivers. But there's still, and I try to explain this to guys now, the people that come to these towns that I'm working in are doing, the people that come there, they come to see something different. They don't come to see TNA or WWE. They're still fans that want to see wrestling. But when they come and you're just giving them the same old stuff in a much watered-down version of what they watched on TV, they're not going to come back. And they don't know how to protect our business.
No, that's a fact.
And I tried to tell a guy that, but he said, well, he said, everybody knows it's work. I said, not everybody does know it's work, but even if they did, you could still make them forget if you had people that knew how to do it. Because like Bobby says, they'll always leave and go, I was there that night.
People still want to believe.
MMA's doing it. Look at the business they're doing. You know, people may get mad, but I tell you, that's the biggest work on TV now. bottom guys don't know it, but them top guys, look here, if there's money involved and it's on television, it's a work.
Yeah, I believe that too.
Yeah, I don't care what it is. You know, horse racing, the wrestling, the MMA fights, to the politicians, it's a work.
Wait a minute now. You mean to tell me the Kentucky Derby's a work? Oh, geez.
I'm sure it is somehow.
Oh, you bet it is.
All you got to do is have one guy.
Yeah, when you're talking that kind of money and that kind of stuff, somebody's manipulating something.
You know, the perfect
fast horses and slow jockeys.
Yes, sir.
You hold them back.
The perfect example is Billy Buckner. Red Sox Mets, the 86 World Series. That was his next to last year playing. His knees were gone. He played all of his life, and the most he'd ever made was like $100,000 in a year. And that was the year everybody started signing million-dollar contracts. You got 8 gold gloves, and you can't get a ground ball that goes between your legs? He took his money and run off. He rode off in the sunset. He lives in Idaho somewhere now and has nothing to do with anybody. But he got paid. They just, I don't know. Maybe if he went into having weed eater matches, he could have had a longer career.
I'm telling you, you've got me tonight. I don't get impressed much, but a weed eater match has got me.
Well, it's not.
I'm going to have to take out myself before I go to bed.
But how has it gotten to that point? You know, there's no art form in hitting somebody with a light bulb as hard as they can. There's no art form in punching somebody in the face as hard as you can. It's a lost art. You know, I don't ever plan on doing anything else, but I know that I'm going to have to because our business is not going to last forever.
I watched last night, and I know we're getting short on time here, but I watched last night, and don't ask me why. I've got to where I like to watch the Golf Channel at night before I go to sleep. I guess it's just calming. But they had this show on called The Haney Project. And this guy Haney is a golf coach, and for the last 6 months he's had Michael Phelps, the Olympic swimmer, and
yeah,
he's been teaching him how to play golf. And it showed the ups and downs and the good times and the bad times. But last night was the season finale, and they had 5 Olympic medalists playing 3 holes for different prizes. But anyway, Sugar Ray Leonard was one of the contestants. And they were there, and Sugar Ray Leonard said, let's just see how tough you swimmers are. He said, I'm a professional boxer. He said, let's see if you can take a punch. And he punched him in the stomach, and he threw a working punch. And Phelps never sold it. He never flinched. He never moved. And it looked like if he'd have doubled over, you'd have believed it. And I thought,
yeah,
he just threw a working punch at the guy, and the guy didn't even know what he did. And this was Renesso told me years ago. He showed me how boxers manipulated the gloves and worked with them, and I thought, well, look at this. But you know, that's why boxing's dead. They got nobody anymore that can do that.
And they smart people up.
Yeah.
You know, that's why the stuff is hot now. They ain't smart nobody up. You know. People get hot at me. You watch baseball, you watch football, it's a work. I know it's a work, but they ain't smarting me up. So
yeah, I ain't figured it out yet.
We all loved it, and we protected it. And it was what we were meant to be, I believe. It's what we wanted to be. But I believe here's the perfect thing. If somebody asks you, why do you want to be a wrestler? We can't tell them. We don't have an answer other than that's all we ever wanted to do. There's not really an answer. You know, I've learned that a long time ago. If you ask a guy, why do you want to be a wrestler? It's fun. I just want to slap him right in the face. Or they think, I'm going to get rich quick. You know, then you really want to hit him. But, you know, we lived by rules and did what we were supposed to do. I don't know. It was entrusted to the next generation and the next generation, and then it just stopped.
It stopped.
As you said, Jerry, everything went on hold. And it's like I told Tom Pritchard once, all my life I did this and taught this and loved this. Now they don't do this, they do that. So I don't know that. And I sure as heck ain't going to let nobody hit me with a light bulb or a weed eater.
Well, guys, I know we're about out of time. I'm going to get my Alka-Seltzer, and I'm going to think about this weed eater thing for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. So, well, Michael, we'll be back with you guys next week. I'll call in a few weeks, and I just want to thank both of you for spending a couple hours with me every Thursday, because I really have enjoyed this.
Bo, you've been a blessing, bud. It's
been fun, bud.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thoroughly enjoyed it, man.
All right. Thank you, Bobby. Next week, Thursday night, 8 o'clock, Michael Norris will be back with Bobby and Jerry, and I hope you are, too. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.